Last Thursday was Thanksgiving Day, the day every American remembers that courageous group of pioneers who sailed the Atlantic in the Mayflower, landed at Plymouth Rock in the winter of the year 1620. It was William Bradford, who, the governor of that infant colony, who called for the first Thanksgiving Day after they'd spent their first year there in Massachusetts, and to celebrate their first harvest and the survival of their first year, which had been a very hard one. Bradford, of course, was, together with a large contingent of his colonists, a refugee from religious persecution in Europe. They were radical Puritans who believed, like Oliver Cromwell, their contemporary, that the Reformation in the English Church hadn't gone far enough, and who were seeking opportunity in a new land to build a nation according to what they believed was a more thoroughgoing and uncompromised principle of Christian liberty. Unlike later European colonists then, they weren't motivated by thoughts of empire or profit. Now, these men on the Mayflower were most emphatically pursuing a religious quest. Bradford himself called them pilgrims, the Pilgrim Fathers. 350 years later, of course, secularism and pluralism and humanism is so dominant in our Western society, one sometimes gets the distinct impression that many Americans are a little embarrassed by their Puritan heritage. So one bright young lady from Texas told me once at a Thanksgiving Day dinner to which I'd been invited, it might have been better, all things considered, she said, if instead of the Pilgrim Fathers landing on the Plymouth Rock had landed on the Pilgrim Fathers. It didn't stop her enjoying her Thanksgiving Day dinner, though, I noticed. And it was clear, even if she didn't share their theology, that that young lady entertained, like most Americans, a nostalgic affinity for those early settlers. The same nostalgic affinity, I suppose, that is responsible for numerous accidental deaths by gunshot wounds every year the deer hunting season opens in the United States. There's something about the pioneer spirit that's exciting to all of us, don't you think? We live too much in the rut. In spite of the prosperity and the comfort that the rut may offer us, there are times, I think, when most of us rebel against its cramping predictability. The Pilgrim Fathers were following a dream. Even though their journey in pursuit of it was beset by the most appalling austerities and adversity, that dream gave them a sense of purpose. They needed that sense of purpose in order to persevere. They were going somewhere, and they knew it. Some of us, I suspect, would give quite a lot to have a dream like that. We live a lot closer to despair than perhaps we dare to admit. Affluent though we may be, our 20th century Western society has lost its goals. Like Hank Marvin in that musical, Paint Your Wagon. Where am I going? I don't know. When will I get there? I ain't certain. I only know that I am on my way. He was a pilgrim who'd lost the dream. And when a pilgrim loses the dream, he becomes just a vagrant. Human race can't long endure that kind of spiritual wanderlust. Where there is no vision, says the Bible, people perish. Well, perish indeed they do. Not by plague or war, but by a slow and tragic process of inner cultural decay. To be a human being is to demand a purpose. Mere survival may satisfy the animals, but it doesn't satisfy us. We must have something to live for. And that's surely why Americans like to commemorate their Pilgrim Fathers. Not just in admiration of their achievement, but in sneaking envy of their dream. If only we could be pilgrims too. If only we could see our lives as a journey with a clear destination in view, as they did. Wouldn't that be great? Well, I've got news for you this morning. Can. The dream that fired the imagination of those early American settlers didn't begin with them, and they would have been the first to tell you so if you'd asked them. No, it began not four centuries ago, but four millennia ago. Not in Plymouth, Massachusetts, but in Ur of the Chaldeans. It began not in the heart of an English Puritan, but in the heart of a Hebrew merchant. And the Bible insists that that dream is still relevant and still available today to any who have the courage, like him, to abandon their rut and join the community of faith of which he was the founder member. So we are starting today on a short series of studies in the life of this pioneer of all pioneers, the very first pilgrim father of all. You know his name? Abraham. And it's my hope that maybe at the end of our studies, some of us who at present are living in the rut without a dream shall have captured his vision and have decided to become pilgrims ourselves. Well, we're going to start this morning with a survey of Genesis chapters 12 to 15. Four chapters, quite a lot of material. These four chapters record the first steps Abraham took on his pilgrimage. And they're chapters that reveal that Abraham's embarkation upon this great march of faith was by no means as firm and as certain as our popular image of the great patriarch might have led us to suppose. There's clear evidence in these chapters that it took some years for Abraham to become fully committed to his dream. And indeed that the dream had to be reaffirmed on a number of occasions to him before he'd fully taken it on board. In fact, in these early years, Abraham was on occasions a rather reluctant pilgrim father. And I want us to focus our study this morning on the elements of the story that expose those elements of reluctance. We must begin, though, with the experience that began the story for him. And you'll find that in chapter 12, verses 1 to 3. The Lord had said to Abraham, "Leave your country, your people, and your father's household, and go to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you." Here then is the first intimation that Abraham was given of the dream that was to mean so much to him and shape his life. I don't think we're speculating over much to guess that it must have shaken him to the core when it first came. For we learn from Joshua chapter 24 that Terah, Abraham's father, worshipped many gods, and that he brought up his sons, Abraham and Nahor, to share his polytheistic inclinations. The dramatic invasion, then, of his life by a god Abraham had presumably never heard of before. Well, I guess it must have come with all the revolutionary force of a religious conversion. We can only speculate about exactly how God communicated this message of verses 2 and 3 to him. Jewish tradition seems to have regarded it as a visionary experience, and Stephen reflects that when in the book of Acts, chapter 7, he speaks of the God of glory appearing to Abraham. But Genesis itself doesn't mention any visual dimension to the encounter. It's much more interested in the words that were spoken. Notice the two distinct elements that compose them. First, a command, leave. And second, a promise, I will. As to the command, I think it's important not to underestimate the huge emotional cost and the personal risk that was being demanded of Abraham by this imperative. Leave your country, he's told, first of all. I think it's quite clear that Abraham's clan were primarily city dwellers. Chapter 14, verse 13, you'll find Abraham called a Hebrew. And while that could just be simply a tribal reference to an earlier ancestor of his, Eber, many scholars believe it identifies Abraham as one of the Habiru, or travelling merchants of the ancient world. That was the original force of the word, Hebrew. And if that's true, that would go a long way towards explaining why his family were associated with towns like Ur and Haran in the narrative. For of course, merchants made their living in the marketplace, and marketplaces only existed in urban settlements where trade routes crossed. That's what Ur and Haran were. So when God tells Abraham to leave his country, he's probably not telling him to abandon his tribal lands. His family may well have had none. He is, however, telling him to abandon his urban environment in which he'd grown up and to become instead some kind of desert nomad. That's no small change, I think you'll agree. A bit like telling a London shopkeeper to go and farm a croft in the Outer Hebrides. Well, not only was he to leave his country, he was also to leave his father's household, we're told. Now remember that Abraham did not live in the kind of state-supported nuclear family that we're familiar with in the 20th century. His entire security, psychologically, financially, even physically, was bound up with his clan. In a world without police forces and social services, he was hugely dependent on the protection of the tribe. Leaving his father's house, then, was a far more momentous step for him than it would have been for most of us. Some of us, I guess, would welcome an excuse to escape the clutches of awkward grandparents or interfering in-laws. But leave for Abraham represented a colossal sacrifice. It meant saying farewell not just to everything that was familiar and loved, but to everything that his personal safety and welfare depended upon. And instead, God offered him what? A promise. A dream. Go to the land I will show you, and I will make you into a great nation. Well, it sounds all very dramatic and romantic and exciting, of course, but if you try to imagine yourself into Abraham's shoes and feel with him the loss of every kind of human support and comfort that was involved, it's not hard, I think, to see what a ridiculous gamble it must have seemed. After all, this man who was going to found an entire nation didn't even have a son to his name yet. And all the indications were that he was unlikely to get one. You'll notice the narrator has already told us in chapter 11, verse 30, that Sarai, his wife, was barren. She had no children. All things considered, then, it would have been surprising indeed if Abraham had been 100% enthusiastic about this call to pilgrimage from day one of his journey. And there are a number of clues in the story which I think clearly indicate that he wasn't. The first clue involves looking back to the end of chapter 11, verses 31 and 32. We read there, Terah took his son Abraham, his grandson Lot, son of Haran, and his daughter-in-law Sarai, the wife of his son Abraham, and together they set out from Ur of the Chaldeans to go to Canaan. But when they came to Canaan, they settled there. Terah lived 205 years and he died in Haran. Now at first this seems rather contradictory, don't you think? For according to chapter 12, verse 5, Abraham's journey to Canaan began in Haran. Yet clearly from these verses, the idea of going to Canaan had been in mind long before, while his family was still living in Ur of the Chaldees. And that's further strengthened by later references in Genesis 15 that we read to the fact that God summoned Abraham out of Ur, not out of Haran. And that's supported too in the New Testament, in Acts 7, again where Stephen says that God's call to Abraham to leave his country and people had come to him while he was still in Ur. It's because of that that the NIV chooses a pluperfect tense in the first verse of chapter 12. The Lord had said to Abraham. Now, inevitably it involves some degree of conjecture, but I find it hard to resist the conclusion from this contrast between the end of chapter 11 and the beginning of chapter 12, that Abraham's response to the word of God, initially at any rate, was rather half-hearted. Partial in its obedience, delayed in its execution. God, after all, had told him to leave his people and his father's house. But far from leaving them, the expeditionary party that sets out for Canaan in 11 verse 31 includes both his father and his nephew. It mustn't be too hard on Abraham for that, perhaps. For one thing, Abraham may have felt, as the firstborn son, he had some inescapable filial duties. His father, no doubt, was getting very old. His nephew Lot was an orphan. Furthermore, it's not impossible that Abraham may have shared his dream with them and they were enthusiastic about it. Maybe his father insisted on leading the family group out of Ur. Nevertheless, the fact remains, though the journey to Canaan was started in verse 31 of chapter 11, they only got as far as Haran. And there we read they settled down again. Presumably to the old family trading business, for Haran was a prosperous mercantile city at the junction of several caravan routes. And it wasn't until Terah, Abraham's father, was dead and buried, and Abraham himself was well on towards middle age, that our pilgrim was able at last to summon the necessary courage to fulfill the command God had given him back in Ur and make a complete break with his past, leaving Haran and at last setting out for Canaan. But even then he was still stuck with Lot, wasn't he? A charge he couldn't now desert. But who was definitely not allowed for in God's original terms of reference, and who, as things turned out, would be a considerable problem to Abraham in later years. It was, then, I suggest, as a rather half-hearted pilgrim that Abraham set out from Ur, and then again later from Haran, to make his journey to Canaan. But then, of how many of us is that true? Our journey to faith is rarely accomplished in a single leap, is it? Many of us are rather halting at first. Bit by bit, God has to detach us from the things that cling to us, from the dependencies upon which we rely. So often there is delay, prevarication, compromise. The dream beckons, but how many of us are not convinced it isn't a fantasy? Hesitate. As Abraham, I suspect, hesitated. Yes, and even when we do get there, when we've made the step of faith, when we have left Haran and got into Canaan, we don't always show the kind of stickability that might be expected of a real pioneer. Look at chapter 12, verse 10. Now there was a famine in the land, and Abraham went down to Egypt to live there for a while, because the famine was severe. A famine in the promised land? Well, God hasn't said anything about famines. Who could blame Abraham for feeling he'd not been shown that piece of the small print in the contract? Camping in the wilderness is all very well when the weather's nice, the summer holiday. But famine, that's a different matter altogether. In a famine you need civilization. You need the comforting security of the big city with the grocer's shop on the corner. Egypt, that's the obvious place to go, and Abraham went. As many another would-be pilgrim has started the path of discipleship but left it when the going got a little tough. As he was about to enter Egypt, we read in verse 11, he said to his wife Sarah, I know what a beautiful woman you are. When the Egyptians see you, they will say, this is his wife, and then they will kill me, but will let you live. Say you are my sister, so that I will be treated well for your sake, and my life will be spared because of you. Rather nice that Sarai was so beautiful, considering she was 65 years of age at this particular time. You have to make allowance for the fact that the patriarchs clearly got older slower than we're used to. But this whole incident's an indication, isn't it, of the vulnerability Abraham felt now in the absence of his tribe. He was on his own. He didn't have a lot of tribal clansmen around him to protect him any longer. The big city could be a dangerous place for a foreigner on his own. And a beautiful woman was a considerable prize in the ancient world. Abraham didn't know what law and order was like in Egypt, but he was familiar enough with the ethics of pagan cities to know that the men who ruled them could usually get away with murder if they wanted to. From a human point of view, then, this little deception was an understandable ploy. But then that's the point, isn't it? Abraham, both in going down to Egypt and in this subterfuge about his wife, was thinking purely from a human point of view. Egypt was not the promised land. God hadn't told him to go there, famine or no famine. He was backtracking on the dream. And Sarai was his wife, danger or no danger. Deceiving the Egyptians into thinking she was his sister was the act of a cunning opportunist, not of a pilgrim father. There can be no doubt, I think, that Abraham's commitment to the dream was slipping. Before long, what do we find? Why, Abraham is doing very well among his new friends in Egypt, thank you very much. Sarai attracts a higher class of customer to Abraham's market stall in the Egyptian bazaars. And pretty soon it's the story of Ur and Haran all over again. Abraham was in danger of settling down. He acquired, verse 16, sheep and cattle, male and female donkeys, men servants and maid servants, and camels. And at the end of the day, we're told, it was only the direct intervention of God in causing plagues on the house of Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, that got Abraham out of this all-too-comfortable situation and back into the place he was meant to be. The Lord inflicted serious diseases on Pharaoh and his household because of Abraham's wife, Sarai. Why did you say she is my sister, so that I took her to be my wife, he asks. Here is your wife, take her and go. And Pharaoh gave orders about Abraham to his men, and they sent him on his way with his wife, and everything he had. It could have been a total disaster, of course. Pharaoh's anger could have led to all kinds of reprisals. As it was, in the providence of God, Abraham came out of Egypt a wealthier and a wiser man. The improvement in his wealth is indicated in the first couple of verses of chapter 13. Abraham went up from Egypt to the Negev with his wife, and everything he had, and Lot went with him. Abraham had become very wealthy in livestock and in silver and in gold. The improvement in his wisdom, however, is, I think, equally obvious, but less explicit. And it emerges in the stories that follow. Reading just a little between the lines, I think it's clear that this experience in Egypt had taught Abraham something. This God he had begun to follow could be trusted, at least as far as his material well-being was concerned. He didn't have to be afraid of poverty. He didn't need the security of the big city. The hesitancy of his early response had been rebuked by those plagues in Egypt. He'd begun to realize just how powerful this God was who'd spoken to him. And the remaining three incidents in chapters 13, 14, and 15, I think, demonstrate that growing degree of confidence our pilgrim father was feeling. The first incident in chapter 13 is the separation of Abraham from Lot. Now, this was always inevitable, of course, because the terms of the original promise required a separation completely from his father's house. But only now, years after the initial departure from Ur, was Lot sufficiently mature and prosperous to carve out an independent life for himself. Even so, one senses some degree of reluctance on Abraham's part. He has to be compelled into this separation by force of circumstances, just as he had to be compelled to leave Egypt by force of circumstances. But what I want you to notice is the agreement that he and Lot came to in verse 12 of chapter 13. Abraham lived in the land of Canaan, while Lot lived among the cities of the plain and pitched his tents near Sodom. Lot then clearly had still not lost his hankering for the urban lifestyle of his youth. We're told in this chapter that when he was given the choice of where to go, he chose a fertile, well-settled plain. Significantly, we're told in verse 10, it was reminiscent of Egypt. And it had cities close at hand, Sodom and Gomorrah. It isn't long before we find Lot living not just near Sodom in tents, but actually in a house within the walls of Sodom. Abraham, on the other hand, albeit by default, rather than by positive choice, goes back into Canaan, the land God had promised him all those years before, the land which God, in response to this final break with his father's house, he's pleased to promise to him once again. Abraham, on the other hand, albeit by default, rather than by positive choice, goes back into Canaan, the land God had promised him all those years before, the land which God, in response to this final break with his father's house, he's pleased to promise to him once again. Verses 14 to 17 of chapter 13. Lift up your eyes from where you are. Look north and south, east and west. All the land that you see I will give to you and your offspring. For I will make your offspring like the dust of the earth. So that if anyone could count the dust, then your offspring could be counted. Go, walk through the length and breadth of the land. I'm giving it to you. I want you to notice in verse 18 how Abraham responds to that. And like Lot, he goes to live not in a house, but in his tents. Not near great cities, but we're told near great trees. And there he builds not a market stall, but an altar to the Lord. It's clear he had learned a lesson, all right, in Egypt. And in chapter 14, we find a second confirmation of that lesson he'd learned. This time in his encounter with Melchizedek. Now, the story of chapter 14 is complicated. It's set in the complex politics of the Near East of Abraham's day. In those days, the politics of the area were dominated by rivalry between the petty monarchs of the city-states that comprised the area. The king of Elam, it seems, had been the most powerful of these monarchs for some time. But about the time when Abraham and Lot were separating, there was an attempted rebellion by five of his vassal cities against the growing military dominance of Elam and its allies. And as it happened, one of these rebel cities was Sodom, where Lot had chosen to go and live. Well, in the ensuing battles, Lot was taken as a prisoner of war, and word quickly got to Abraham on the Bush Telegraph, telling him of his nephew's capture. Clan loyalty demanded that Abraham do something about it, and do something he did. In a daring commando raid by night, he and his men, together with the forces of a couple of other desert sheiks who he'd allied with in Canaan, successfully routed the forces of the king of Elam and recovered not only Lot, but also a great deal of booty and many other people who'd been captured from the city of Sodom. But all things considered, it was a momentous triumph. I've no doubt it established Abraham's reputation in the region. But what I want you to notice is his personal reaction to the victory. In verses 18 to 20 of chapter 14. Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was priest of God Most High, and he blessed Abraham, saying, "Blessed be Abraham by God Most High, creator of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who delivered your enemies into your hand." Then Abraham gave him a tenth of everything. Now, I suppose Melchizedek must be ranked as one of the most mysterious characters in the whole Bible. He's a study in himself. He appears out of nowhere, yet clearly Abraham recognizes in him a personage of great significance and authority. He gives him a tenth of the spoils of battle, a gesture which in normal circumstances, I think, would have implied that Abraham recognized himself either as a vassal or an ally of this king of Salem. But in this case, it seems to have been a religious rather than a political act. A payment of tithes rather than of tribute. Melchizedek was one of the few people in the ancient world, it seems, outside his own family, in whom Abraham could recognize the same monotheistic faith which he had discovered. Where had Melchizedek learnt this monotheistic faith? Well, your guess is as good as mine. Some have speculated that he was in fact Shem, one of the sons of Noah, to whom Genesis attributes a lifespan of 500 years, which would make him a rather senile contemporary of Abraham. Others, tantalized by the New Testament vibrations of this bread and wine that he brings out, and by some of the things that the book of Hebrews says about him, have speculated that he was none other than a pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus Christ. I don't think either of those suggestions are terribly plausible. But whoever he was, the blessing he pronounces on Abraham clearly indicates that our pilgrim knows that he'd got out of this particular scrape with the king of Elam just as he'd got out of the clutches of the Pharaoh of Egypt, not by his own human cunning and skill, but by divine deliverance. Blessed be God Most High, who delivered your enemies into your hand. And the vow which Abraham makes, presumably in Melchizedek's presence, proves that point, verse 21. The king of Sodom said to Abraham, "Give me the people and keep the goods for yourself." But Abraham said to the king of Sodom, "I've raised my hand to the Lord God Most High, creator of heaven and earth, and have taken an oath that I will accept nothing belonging to you, not even a thread or the thong of a sandal, so that you will never be able to say, 'I have made Abraham rich.'" See, Egypt had taught Abraham something. It had taught him the folly of getting entangled with pagan cities and pagan kings. The only security worthy of the name Abraham knew now was the security of having God Most High on his side. He and Melchizedek understood that and shared that in this intimate meal they shared. But the king of Sodom didn't understand that, and he never would. It had been a hard lesson to learn, and it had taken Abraham longer to learn it than it should have done. But learn it he has. Never again was he going to rely for his prosperity or for his protection upon people like the king of Sodom and the cities they ruled. Our hesitant pilgrim had at last become a convinced pilgrim. He was prepared to renounce the world for the sake of his dream. And to that point, all of us who want to become pilgrims must also come. "Do not love the world," says the apostle. If anybody loves the world, the love of the Father isn't in him. "You cannot serve God and money," said Jesus to his disciples. Some of us, I'm afraid, never get to that point, do we? The prospect of worldly security is too much for us. We stay in Egypt. We will not lift our hand and reject the offer of the king of Sodom. Seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. Now, some of us are happy to seek it second, but not to seek it first, because we don't trust the promise that all these things will be added to us. But Abraham had got there. He was at last a fully convinced pilgrim, and the final incident of our study passage this morning brings that home, I think, with extraordinary power. It's the incident that we read in chapter 15, the story of the sealing of the covenant. After this, the word of the Lord came to Abraham in a vision. Do not be afraid, Abraham. I am your shield, your very great reward. But Abraham said, O sovereign Lord, what can you give me, since I remain childless, and the one who will inherit my estate is Eliezer of Damascus? Oh, Abraham may have become a pilgrim, but he had not yet become a pilgrim's father. And his relationship with God had so grown in trust and intimacy that he felt now able to vocalize that dissatisfaction with unbridled candor. All right, God, I agree. You've convinced me. You are able to be my shield, just like you say. I don't have to be afraid for my welfare anymore. The experiences of the last few years have taught me that. You are able to protect me. But I still have a problem, God, about this reward you keep talking about. For how can a man without children be the father of many nations? As my last will and testament stands at the present moment, I've had to name Eliezer of Damascus as my heir. Well, he's a nice enough chap, but he's just a servant in my household. He doesn't represent the fulfillment of that promise you gave me. He's not part of the dream. Frankly, God, if you don't give me a son, you may as well have given me nothing. Any of us who've known the pain of childlessness will not find it hard to sympathize with the frustration and disappointment of Abraham at this moment. But I wonder if any of us can really identify fully with the next exchange in this remarkable conversation. Look at verse 4. Then the word of the Lord came to him. This man will not be your heir, but a son coming from your own body will be your heir. He took him outside and said, look at the heavens and count the stars, if indeed you can count them. And then he said to him, so shall your offspring be. And then we read, Abraham believed the Lord, and he credited it to him as righteousness. Now, of course, we want to protest, don't we? But surely Abraham had believed in God long before this moment. Hadn't he believed in him from the very moment he set out from Ur? Well, of course, in a sense, yes, he had. But as we've seen this morning, that had been a very hesitant faith. A faith limited by all kinds of mental reservations and private skepticisms and unresolved dependencies. Only in the separation from Lot and in his vow to Melchizedek had the props been finally stripped away from him. Only now was he at last standing before God as a man who was content to have nothing in the world to rely on. Except the promise. Except the dream that God had given him. And that, you see, is the very special kind of faith that the Bible calls saving faith. Justifying faith. That's the kind of faith that distinguishes a mere theist from a true believer. That's the kind of faith that separates a mere churchgoer from a real Christian. Saving faith is not a matter of believing God exists. The devil does that. Saving faith is not a matter of believing that God sometimes answers your prayers. Pagans believe that. Now, saving faith is the faith of a man like Abraham, who knows he's helpless. He's impotent. There's nothing he can do to provide himself with a future, with a security. Nothing at all. And yet as he hovers on the brink of the hopelessness which inevitably accompanies such a radical renunciation of all confidence in our own resources, he finds himself falling not into despair, but into the arms of God. As far as his future prosperity was concerned, Abraham believed in the Lord. He had nothing else any longer to believe in. As Paul so eloquently puts it in the New Testament, against all hope, Abraham believed in hope. He faced the fact that his own body was as good as dead, and Sarah's womb was also dead, yet he did not waver through unbelief regarding the promise of God. But being strengthened in his faith, he was fully persuaded that God had the power to do as he had promised. And that, says the apostle, is why it was credited to him as righteousness. Abraham here provides then the perfect illustration for what the Bible means by saving faith. Not mere credence, not mere theology, not mere emotion at an evangelistic meeting, not mere self-hypnosis conjured up by some book on positive thinking. Saving faith is the faith of Abraham, a faith which has abandoned all trust in its own resources, in its own abilities, in its own works, and is at last content to look to God, and God alone, for mercy, for grace, for a future. It's with men and women who demonstrate a faith like that that the Lord of heaven is pleased to count righteous. It's upon men and women like that that he is pleased to bestow the irrevocable and unconditional assurances of his covenant. And that's what he goes on to do for Abraham. Verse 8, Abraham said, O sovereign Lord, how can I know that I will gain possession of it? So the Lord said to him, bring me a heifer, a goat, and a ram, each 3 years old, along with a dove and a young pigeon. Abraham brought all these to him, cut them in two, and arranged the halves opposite each other. Verse 17, when the sun had set and darkness had fallen, a smoking firepot and a blazing torch appeared and passed between these pieces. And on that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abraham. Now, this is a passage of such importance, it's almost an insult to deal with it in the closing minutes of our address this morning. But we've come such a long way in company with our first pilgrim father. It would be an anticlimax to stop short of this, which was the high spot of his early experience of God. To understand it, you have to grasp a little of the significance of covenant-making ceremonies in the ancient world. These animals, which Abraham kills and divides, were not sacrificial offerings of the normal sort. It was a widespread practice in the ancient world when making a solemn agreement to stand between such sundered corpses of animals as you, as it were, shook hands on the deal and made your promise. The clue to the significance of this strange ritual you can find, if you're interested, in Jeremiah chapter 34, verse 18. We read there, the men who violated my covenant, I will make like the calf they cut in two and walked between its pieces. That's the point. The slaughtered beast was a graphic and an emotive sign of the seriousness of the pact involved. If it was broken, then the guilty party, the one who had broken the covenant, would incur in himself the same gruesome fate as had befallen these animals. In fact, a form of words we come across again and again in the Old Testament probably preserves for us the form of the curse which a participant in such a covenant would invoke upon himself in confirmation of his promise. So let it be to me, and more also, if I do not fulfill my word. Well, seen against this background, then, you see, there are two remarkable features about this particular covenant-making ceremony. The first is, of course, that one of the participants in this covenant ceremony was God. The Lord was making a covenant with Abraham, a man. That in itself is most remarkable. But the most extraordinary thing about it, of course, is that if you look carefully, you will see that God is, in fact, the only active participant in this covenant ceremony. You notice in verse 12 that Abraham fell into a deep sleep. Having prepared the carcasses and kept them free from vultures and crows, he is effectively anaesthetized for the rest of the incident. He sees and hears, but he plays no further active role. It is God alone who speaks. It is God alone who makes promises. And it is God alone who, in this symbol of fire and cloud, the smoking pot and the blazing torch, passes between the pieces of the animals. God, then, in this extraordinary ceremony, was taking upon himself and himself alone the full responsibility for the fulfillment of this covenant pledge. It didn't depend on Abraham. It was an unconditional, unilateral declaration of God's intent. You ask how you can be sure, Abraham. You can be sure because I, the God who cannot lie, have gone on oath this day to confirm it to you. If this covenant relationship between us is broken, then I, God, will pay the penalty. I, God, will accept the curse. And if you think about it, I think you will realize what a very remarkable thing that is. 4,000 years ago it was that God made that covenant promise. 2,000 years ago it was that he kept it. Listen to these words of Paul. Christ has redeemed us from the curse by becoming a curse for us. It is written, cursed is everyone who hangs on a tree. He redeemed us from the curse in order that the blessing given to Abraham might come to us, so that we, by faith, might receive the promise. See what I mean when I said at the very beginning, Abraham's dream, according to the Bible, can be our dream too. Who are these peoples of the earth whom God said in that initial blessing would be blessed through Abraham? Well, the New Testament tells us we are those peoples of the earth. Every one of us who, like Abraham, has found that justifying faith, that saving faith that looks away from itself and looks to God alone for a future and a hope. We are the heirs of Abraham. We are the seed of the covenant. Oh, I guess, like Abraham, our pilgrimage has been in all kinds of ways imperfect and unsatisfactory, isn't it? Some of us, perhaps, like Abraham, can remember a time in our lives when we didn't worship God at all. We worshipped foreign gods, false ideologies, occult powers even. Some of us, perhaps, can remember times in our lives when we backslid, when we took refuge in Egypt because the going was too tough and we didn't fancy the path of discipleship any longer. Some of us, perhaps, like Abraham, have demonstrated an obedience which has been partial, delayed. Perhaps like him, we heard the call to pilgrimage long ago. But years have passed. Like him, perhaps, we're well on the way to middle age now. And we're still living in the halfway house of Haran, unable to make the break with the past that God requires of us. Perhaps like Abraham, some of us have been hampered by our families, by our companions, by our material ties, by our fears, by our failures. But maybe some of us, like Abraham too, are at the end of ourselves today. It's no good, we're saying. Even God can't solve my problems. There can be no dream for me. But I'm here to tell you, it's precisely for people like that, who are at the end of their own resources, that this dream is intended. Look out from your self-despair. Just as childless Abraham looked up at that star-studded night sky, Look away from your disappointments and your failures and your inadequacies and your hopelessness. And look instead at the sundered body. Look instead at the cross. Jesus says to every believer among us this morning, this is the blood of the covenant. This is the curse which you deserve, but which God, according to his ancient oath, has borne himself on your behalf. You don't have to stay in the rut any longer. Abraham's promise is your promise. Abraham's pilgrimage is your pilgrimage. Abraham's dream is your dream. Let's pray together.